The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside for our monthly Q&A. I think that this is sort of a record for the distance between the people involved in this. Adam, I think you're somewhere in southwestern Utah, and Elisa, you're in some secret location holed up with in the witness relocation program, and I'm, of course, in Salt Lake City because I don't go anywhere. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So you're not in St. George because you have conflicts. You haven't developed new conflicts.
No new conflicts. Lots of patients. No new conflicts.
Okay. Well, thanks for being available. I mean, that's really part of what we're doing with all this anyway, isn't it? Is trying to extend your reach to all over the state. There's a possibility in our question tonight that there may be some off-label medication. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
So much of pediatrics.
To be honest, I would have to look to see if it's off-label. I just dose it for the kids, and I think it is off-label, though.
Right, given that so much of what we do is unfortunately off-label. Well, let's get started with the questions. So the first question I'll just read it to you. What's the role of tilt table testing for patients with syncope? We hear a lot about tilt tables, but I don't have a lot of patients who end up on a tilt table. When should they?
It's a really good question. If you refer a patient to the cardiology clinic at the University of Utah, they will never get a tilt table because we don't do them. It doesn't mean that there's no clinical utility. A lot of the physicians there that I trained under said and taught me that I can make anybody pass out on a tilt table. And so I think that the real challenge with tilt tables is the interpretation of the testing and the number of false positives and false negatives as well. So you could have a patient experiencing, you know, vasovagal type symptoms and give that as a history and then put them on a tilt table and not elicit any symptoms. And you could have somebody who doesn't really have that history and put them on a tilt table and then they could pass out. So I think that it makes the interpretation challenging. There are certainly people who are, you know, are smarter than me who use tilt tables in their evaluation of dysautonomias. And there may be a role in patients who have more maybe behavioral psychogenic type syncopal episodes to see if they are truly having rhythm changes or blood pressure changes when you move them from a lying position to a standing position. But the standard for our division of cardiology has just been to focus primarily on the history. We just don't use tilt tables. In fact, in all of my cardiology time at Primary Children's and the University of Utah, I've never been involved in a tilt table test. So I certainly don't consider myself an expert in that area, but reading the literature, the challenges that I see with it are the, you know, the sensitivity and specificity. In addition, if you look at the, you know, the different treatment algorithms based on positive or negative tilts, you end up getting to a lot of the same lifestyle modifications that you would with history alone. And so I think that it is a time-consuming and, you know, uncomfortable test that doesn't necessarily change our management too much. I'm going to recommend the increased fluids, the salt, the compression pants or socks, regardless of whether I have a tilt or not.
And in some ways, it sounds like what you're saying is that while there may be some sort of ambiguous cases where it's helpful for us to collaborate with you, that we can also make a pretty good diagnosis just in the office based on the same sorts of things, on history and maybe orthostatic blood pressures, that sort of thing, and ruling out some of the worrisome other possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that many of the, you know, physicians that deal with these kids, be they general pediatricians or other specialists are able to give a lot of the same information. I have found in all of my training that sometimes parents need to hear it multiple times before they truly believe that that's the answer. And so we recognize that even when people have counseled regarding that, sometimes families want to talk to other people about it. And I think that that's okay. But, you know, given what we know, and if you can elicit a strong history of, you know, reflex syncope, vasovagal syncope, orthostatic hypotension, whatever you want to call it, then really counseling on the lifestyle modifications is helpful. Because as a cardiologist too, and when I am considering medications for these patients, if they have, you know, seen their primary care physician and the primary care physician has made all of those recommendations and the family has truly made efforts doing that, then after they see me, I won't necessarily start with that, right? If they tell me, yeah, I'm drinking, you know, 3 liters a day, I pee every 3 hours, clear urine, I'm taking electrolyte tablets, I wear compression socks, and I still feel uncomfortable, at that point I say, well, let's talk about possible medications to deal with this.
And if you consider medications, which ones generally would you use?
I think that when you are talking about medications, eliciting what the primary issue is for the patient is really important. So some people have more of the POTS type response where they have a lot of tachycardia, and the tachycardia is what is primarily driving their discomfort. And in those cases, I'll use a beta blocker. Other times you'll see really low blood pressures and orthostatic dizziness that might respond better to something like midodrine. Trying to elicit what their main concern is, and then starting them on a low dose medication is typically what I do.
Terrific. We got a couple of questions based on the diagnostic episode. There are lots of different sizes of stethoscopes, but I think most of us end up using an adult size stethoscope. Is there a virtue in using a smaller, for example, one of the neonatal size stethoscopes in examining our patients?
I think that it depends on where you're primarily working. If you're a newborn ICU physician, then a small stethoscope is likely going to be beneficial for you. And being able to kind of isolate sounds on that baby's chest. The challenge with some of those babies is that they're so thin that you hear the sounds no matter where you are. Mm-hmm. For most of us, and having the adult stethoscope, I mean, the classic stethoscope that has sort of a diaphragm side and a bell side, most of the time I think that both of those are covered with a membrane. And most of the newer stethoscopes have kind of an adjustable membrane on them, where if you use light pressure, you're really using more of the bell dynamics and you are going to hear lower frequency sounds. And if you push down with the stethoscope, then you are going to hear the higher frequency sounds. And so, you know, even though there is one side that looks flat and the other side looks more like the bell, that adjustable sound and adjustable technology is present on most of our stethoscopes. And so for most of us, I think having just a standard two-sided stethoscope, one larger, one smaller, works fine. And that's what I use. And even when I examine neonates, I mean, in the newborn ICU, we're using their stethoscopes, right? But when I examine kids in clinic, that's what I use. So even on the babies, I just use the smaller side of my standard Lippmann 3M cardiology stethoscope.
So what you're saying is that still the most important part of the instrument is the ears that the stethoscope is plugged into, and the brain is the ears?
The ears are important. The ears are important. My grandfather was hard of hearing, and as a cardiologist, it's my biggest fear that someday I'll go deaf. You know, I think that most well-made stethoscopes do a fine job, and people have their preferences. I have never used the electronic stethoscopes. I actually am curious. And after the episode where we try to incorporate heart sounds, I think that I should invest, and maybe someday I can give you guys a true library of pediatric heart sounds. But for now, the Michigan heart sounds were pretty good.
They were great. And we really appreciate that. Last question. The implementation of oximetry-based CCHD testing in the nursery really has been a great screening tool. Remind me what conditions might be missed with that screening and what we should be especially on guard for in the nursery?
So yeah, that's a really great question. So when we are using the newborn screen, we have to think about what we are trying to capture. And the low saturations or a difference in saturations is going to be, and has shown to be really beneficial in capturing the critical congenital heart disease. For most of these things we are looking for, with the low saturation, just mixing lesions. So, you know, the classic five, when you talk about your truncus, transposition, tricuspid atresia, tetralogy of Fallot, and total anomalous pulmonary veins. The tetralogy of Fallot in that group is more challenging because we all know that we can have kids with pink tet. And so that is one where you might not capture a lower oxygen saturation, and you might pick it up with auscultation and sounds of pulmonary stenosis. When we measure upper and lower extremity saturations and check to see if there is a difference there, I think that a lot of people think that we are checking for coarctation in that situation. You have to remember that with coarctation, the saturations should be the same between upper and lower extremity unless you have significant pulmonary hypertension and you are actually shunting from the right to the left across the PDA. So if you have that situation, then you're going to notice a saturation difference. And sometimes that will be present, but in other times the duct might still be open at 24 hours when you're checking these kids, or it might be big enough that there's no saturation difference and you have a left to right shunt through that PDA. And those are the kids that tend to get into trouble. I would advocate that all pediatricians are really intentional about feeling lower extremity pulses. And I think I've said that already, but on all newborn visits, if you're seeing a kid for the first time in clinic, really making sure that you are confident that you feel lower extremity pulses, either, you know, you can check their feet or just in their femoral artery. And if you have any question at all, then I would advocate doing an upper and lower extremity blood pressure or calling us to get the child evaluated more quickly. But coarctation is one where they might sneak through the CCHD screen with a normal saturation and can get into trouble soon after that. Other defects, things like VSDs, ASDs, those, you know, you probably won't pick up with CCHD screening. So that'll be auscultation. And we do have situations where, you know, a parent will come to us and say, yeah, they totally missed this in the newborn period. And then they heard it at their first check at a few weeks of life. And, you know, we always talk to the families about how the circulation is dynamic and that the pressures in the lungs may have made it so that there, you know, there actually wasn't a lot of shunting through a VSD. And so that's a common situation where, you know, if somebody doesn't hear something in the newborn nursery, but then hears it at the, you know, the first well child visit, they shouldn't beat themselves up for that.
You know, it's interesting. A wiser pediatrician than I, Bill Cosgrove, used to say that transition is tricky because it's evaluating a patient coming off a placental heart-lung bypass. And it really is a matter of watching a baby change completely from being a fetus to being an infant. And despite the fact that it goes well most of the time, it can be a little rocky.
Yeah, and it's challenging to know how to follow those kids. I mean, I think we've all had kids who got an evaluation for low oxygen saturations and we send them home on a little bit of oxygen and knowing when the appropriate time to take them off of that oxygen, you know, when that arrives. So that transition is sometimes a hard one. You know, I think that if they've had a normal echo without a lot of signs of pulmonary hypertension, then if they have normal sats in clinic throughout the visit, it's probably okay to take them off.
Perfect. Well, Adam, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for getting back with us on these questions. Wish you all the best and hope to have you back as a guest again someday.
I would love it. Thanks so much for all you do.
And for those of you who have any further questions, I'm sure Adam would welcome your questions at any point. And anything related to the podcast, please contact us. We're happy to learn to do this better. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.